The COVID-19 pandemic 1 year later. This is First Coast Connect. Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, we'll take a look at where we are and what lies ahead 1 year into the COVID-19 pandemic. If you've got a question, give us a call at 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest on the coronavirus pandemic, as we mark 1 year since the pandemic started. Yesterday, the Department of Health reported that statewide, the number of Florida coronavirus cases increased by 4,853 to 1,957,586. Active hospitalizations declined by 99 to 3,211, and deaths rose by 59 to 31,948. Meanwhile, 3,784,870 Floridians have had at least one dose of the vaccine. For many of us here in Northeast Florida, the official anniversary of COVID is March 12th. That's the day the Players Championship announced it would be closed to fans. But March 11th was the day the World Health Organization declared a COVID global pandemic, the day that Tom Hanks declared he'd contracted the virus, and the day that the NBA became the first American pro sports league to suspend its season. Given this milestone, about which President Biden will speak this evening in a national address, we wanted to take a look at what we've learned and the progress we've made over the last 12 months. And like everyone else, we're wondering what lies ahead. To discuss this, we're joined now by Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen, Chief of the Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF Health Jax. Dr. Goldhagen, you come at this issue from several vantage points. You were the former director of the Duval County Health Department. You are now a pediatric care specialist, but also an expert in pediatric palliative care or end-of-life care. On this day, what are your thoughts as you look back a year into the official start of the pandemic? Dr. Goldhagen, have I got you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm well. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you and the folks in Radio Land.
Thanks so much for being here. Sorry for the little glitch there. So we are looking back a year into this pandemic. Have you got any big picture thoughts that you think of looking back now that we're 1 year in?
Well, we're 1 year into the pandemic. 5,000 people, as you said, have contracted the disease and are testing positive. We still have thousands of people in being hospitalized. We have thousands of people that are still dying nationwide. And so this pandemic is not over. And there's been a tremendous amount that we've learned, and in particular, We need to think of this pandemic as a lens that magnifies the inequities that currently exist and have existed. So the opportunity now, as we begin perhaps to emerge from the acute phase, is to really focus on what we've learned, because this is not the last pandemic. We know that there are many, many viruses, hundreds of thousands of viruses that are lurking out there, any one of which could, in fact, be the next COVID-19, and some of which might be spread by mosquito and other insects and so on. So the real opportunity for us now is to learn the lessons that are available from COVID and identify the inequities that it has unmasked and address them.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, that you talk about, you know, mosquito-borne illnesses. There was a time when Zika seemed to be the next looming pandemic. I wonder what has surprised you about the evolution of this virus and the way that it's been received.
Well, I think what's surprised me, but maybe not so much, is the American public's response to it and how politicized the virus became and the response to the virus, and the lack of a cogent and rigorous response that resulted in 500,000 plus deaths, that somehow the American public has been able to push into their unconscious and not respond. And so I think that really is the lesson for public health. How do we prepare the public to respond to emergencies and urgencies that result in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, even within our own six-county region? Duval County, the mayor implemented a mask requirement early, which was courageous and the appropriate approach. Other counties around did not. And so even within our own community, we can see the differences in approaches to this disease. It's really important to understand, just before the pandemic hit, there was a study actually in a cave out in China that identified 400 different viruses that hadn't been identified before. And then they looked at the blood of the villagers around that cave and found that many of them had been exposed to those viruses, and that fought them off. But any one of them could have been as bad as COVID or worse. And so the real issue for us is to develop a public health approach that will be valid and successful in the future. The other part of what we're experiencing is the almost complete dismantling of public health across the country, but in particular in Florida and in particular in Duval County. So when this pandemic hit, we were not able to respond because of political decisions that had been made to dismantle the public health system, and it was not able to respond, resulting in significant morbidity and the deaths of thousands of people that did not need to die.
I wonder about that. I mean, obviously, we've discussed that, and I know working in media, we've experienced a lot of frustration in terms of being able to get answers from our local health department or our state health department. In fact, just this week, we saw the FEMA site at Gateway, which had been providing daily numbers of how many people were coming and getting vaccinated, cease when the state pulled back control about who is going to disclose those numbers. So it went from like a daily update, which had some not entirely flattering numbers, honestly, the first couple of days, although there was a big uptick on Monday. But that control that that the state seems to want, and the defunding that I think precipitated some of this inability to cope with this pandemic, what is the motive behind that? Do you have any sense? I mean, obviously, you've got a big background in public health. You worked with the health department for years. What's motivating that?
That's a really good question. What motivated the defunding of public health, not only in Florida and not only in our own community, but nationally? The only explanation is that it is a political decision made to ensure that there is centralization control of messages and control of funds at the state level. It's the antithesis of what public health is. Public health is local. All public health is local. And the irony is that Florida years ago had amongst the best health departments, state health departments in the country, because it was decentralized. There were 67 counties in Florida. There were 63 health departments. All of them had a close working relationship with the local community. Many of the municipalities thought in some ways that the health department was theirs. There were experts at the state level that provided expertise and consultation to the local health departments. And it was a superb system, in part honed to that degree by the response to hurricanes and, interestingly enough, by the necessity to prepare after 9/11.
How do we get back to that? I mean, what's
made to dismantle it?
How would we recover a more robust public health system that you say is needed to kind of prepare for future pandemics?
Well, these are political decisions that were made, and the public needs to demand that, in fact, public health be refunded. And that it become robust in order to be able to protect them from this disease. I can tell you very definitively that with a robust public health system, we would not have experienced the mortality and the pain and suffering that we experienced. There's knowledge and expertise and experience out there to have prevented what we have experienced. And you don't have to look any further than other countries who generated a robust response. And the U.S., you know, with all of our expertise and with all of our resources, had undoubtedly the worst and most devastating response among high-income developed countries around the world. And the death of hundreds of thousands of people could have been prevented.
The time that this is occurring in, you know, we are talking often about it being, you know, an age of particular misinformation. I wonder if you think that played a larger role in terms of the difficulties in getting this, you know, preventing the spread of COVID, or if you think that it's just something more fundamental in human nature that is resistant or subject even to peer pressure in the most basic sense, in when it comes to things like masking or vaccinations?
Well, I would say it was much less misinformation and far more it became a political issue and a political pawn that was used by the Trump administration. And so it wasn't so much the misinformation, it was a set of political decisions that were made at the federal level and then reverberated at the state level that resulted in significant mortality and morbidity. And we're seeing now, and I want to move from the politics of it to just the sheer focus of what we're seeing now, and that is a robust response. But this is not going. There's not going to be an end to COVID. There'll be a tail to COVID, and that tail will last a long time. And really, the only issue that I think is the most germane now is what we have learned from it to be able to prevent the next pandemic.
What about health disparities? It's something that has been discussed much this year, and I wonder if it's something that COVID exacerbated or simply revealed that already existed, and whether we're seeing it not just because of COVID, but also because of the moment that we're in terms of social justice and increased awareness.
Well, I think it did both. It both unmasked the issues that, frankly, we knew existed. But it magnified those existed as far as recognition of them, and then increased the extent of the disparities, which we would prefer to think of in terms of inequities, which are in a sense issues that can be addressed. And ironically, the direct impact of COVID was primarily in adults and primarily in older adults. The indirect impact has been far more impactful on children than adults. And again, children weren't immune to the disease and were impacted by the disease. We've had over 50 children in Wolfson Children's Hospital with MISC, which is the disease that impacts them so significantly. So the disease both magnified our understanding of the disparities and inequities that exist, and then expanded those as well.
The changing guidance in some of the areas of COVID prevention, I was recalling, you know, a year ago going somewhere where no one was wearing masks, but everybody was being really assiduous about hand washing, which, you know, at the time there was a kind of an official message discouraging masks. Is that something that you think has contributed to this difficulty sometimes in getting people on board is the fact that the message has shifted. And what would you have proposed as an alternative from the jump?
Well, I think that's part of the issue, but it's all part of learning. It's all part of science. It's all part of public health. The more you learn, the more it impacts the messaging. But I think what was even more critical was the diversity of messages, the inconsistency of messages, the lack of a consistent message from the federal government. The issues that we saw every night on television, where we had the administration saying one thing and the experts like Dr. Fauci saying another thing. So it became a complete disarray of messages, and people really didn't have an understanding or a sense of who to listen to. And so I think it was that issue which was primarily had the primary impact. The other issue, which I think is really very germane now, which is the inequity in the distribution of vaccine. And somehow our elected officials have assumed that if they opened up testing sites, number one, and now immunization sites, number two, that is the extent of what the responsibility is. But in fact, it's only part of it. It's certainly necessary, but not sufficient. We need appropriate messages that are geared to the communities that are most at risk. And we started a consortium called the Population Health Consortium of Northeast Florida that has brought together multiple medical and health organizations like the Duval County Medical Society, the Northeast Florida Medical Society, which is the organization of black physicians in the community, to try to fill that gap. And we've had community conversations, we're trying to learn what people think about the vaccine and are fashioning and structuring messages that are specific to the communities that need to be addressed. So if there's a vacuum, of appropriate messaging to at-risk communities, those communities will fill the void and others will fill the void with misinformation. So part of it is misinformation, but the reason why misinformation is allowed to expand is because there's been a deficiency of appropriate messaging to those communities. And that's something that needs to happen immediately, because what we're seeing is that the communities that are most at risk are the ones that are not being vaccinated. And we attribute that to vaccine hesitancy and, oh, that's because of X, Y, and Z, which is true. But it's also because we haven't taken the time and worked really hard to fashion appropriate messages for those communities that are most at risk.
The issue of confusion, under a prior administration, I think is well taken. But we're also seeing a fair amount of messaging confusion about eligibility for vaccines. And we've got a new president and a new administration. What explains that ongoing messaging problem that we're having about who can get it, where they can get it, from day to day, whether that's changing, whether there's leftovers, all of those questions?
Well, again, I would say that it's because of two things, one of which is that we've dismantled public health. There is no single messenger. There's not a representative of the Duval County Health Department, which is now the Florida Health Department in Duval. There's no single messenger. We have, with all due respect to our politicians, in particular Mayor Curry, who was courageous and implemented the mask requirement. He's not a public health official. He's not a public health expert. And we have had a lack of a singular appropriate message coming from the public health department. So as a result, there are multiple messages coming in from multiple entities, from the health department, from the city, from the state, from the federal government, and there's been no consistency in messaging, which is is a primary principle of public health. And we think of it in terms in public health of high risk, low trust communication. And there's a whole science between, there's a whole science about how do you communicate in high risk, low trust environments. And we haven't had that available to us at the federal level, at the state mm-hmm. level, and at the community level.
Yeah. Let's look ahead a little bit and see what your thoughts are about, first of all, whether you're looking forward with some optimism now that we're starting to see vaccinations on a much larger scale, and, you know, perhaps some of the more vulnerable people from a health standpoint getting those shots. What are you seeing ahead in the next weeks and months that gives you a cause for hope?
Well, that's a really difficult question. So if everything remained the same, there is certainly going to be improvement over time, number one. But number two is there are still thousands of people that are dying. That's number two. Number three is we still are at significant risk of variants. And variants of this virus taking hold. We know that about 20%+ of new cases now in Florida are the variant. Any one of those current ones, but in particular new ones, could result in a lack of efficacy of the current vaccines. So now's not the time to lower our guard. And that's the most concerning to me. You know, it's like a person, getting chemotherapy with a cancer. The cancer is, chemotherapy is working and the person's feeling better. And then the decision's made, well, let's stop chemo by the individual. Let's stop chemotherapy because I'm feeling better. And then the cancer comes back in a way that is perhaps more vicious than it was before. I think that's where we are right now. And what we're seeing across the country and in Florida is that people are lowering their guard, which will just create an environment that is conducive for the variants to take hold. And I'm really disappointed in our governor who, you know, Florida came out a couple weeks ago. Florida was the only state in the country that didn't have a plan. Our governor seemed to think that that was really very appropriate and the appropriate place to be. We have not had a plan, and now is not the time to disregard that opportunity. We need to learn from the experience we've had and really take the time to put those plans in place. And if it's not going to happen at the state level, then we need to make that happen at the local level.
Well, lots of lessons learned in the last year. Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen, Chief of the Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF Health JAX. Thank you, Dr. Goldhagen, for being with us this morning.
Yeah, and let me just take one step back and thank you and the media and our community for really taking the lead in communicating to our community. And the role that you all play is incredibly important, in particular with the void of public health messaging. And so we as a whole community need to thank you all.
Well, thank you too. You know, your voice is a very central part of this whole discussion that we've been having. So we do appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Goldhagen.
Take care. Bye.
Later, what a possible increase in Duval County's gas tax might mean to you. But up next, new research into critical thinking. We'll be right back. Welcome back. New research suggests that those with extremist views have difficulty with complex mental tasks, and it's not happening in a vacuum. American high school and college students are suffering from a major setback. They don't know how to think critically, and the health, safety, and economy of America are all at risk because of it. Professor and critical thinking analyst Stephen Perlman's latest book is called America's Critical Thinking Crisis: The Failure and Promise of Education. And it argues that the problem doesn't lie with educators or Gen Z, but with a fundamentally flawed conception of what education means. He recently spoke with Melissa. Let's take a listen. Stephen Perlman, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This topic, I think, is so important to talk about at any time, but particularly right now, in the midst of this pandemic and in the wake of the insurrection at the Capitol, where we saw a lot of people storming Washington based on faulty information and false beliefs. When you talk about the crisis in critical thinking in our classrooms, I want to begin by asking you, who do you think is to blame for our failure as a country to teach students critical thinking skills?
Well, broadly, the answer lies in educators and in the educational system. But I want to be clear that I really don't fault educators themselves for this, any individual educator. The means of teaching critical thinking is something that's really relatively new. And so most educators have never been trained in this, and I don't think we can really fault them for that. But broadly, we have an educational system that was predicated on a factory model and on moving students through at a continuous pace, and built on developing and knowing the right answers to things and based on learning information and regurgitating information. And those premises now are outdated, and they're not helping us anymore in modern society.
Yeah. And teachers themselves complain that they are incredibly frustrated at being forced to teach kids to just do well on standardized tests in particular. So
that's very true. And we have educators who often come to us and are saying that, for example, part of the Common Core asks for analytic thinking, and many educators want to involve more critical thinking in their classes, and they simply say, we've never been told how to do it.
Why is this, in your view, why does this rise to the level of a crisis? That we're raising children in a time of incredibly fast technological and social change. We're raising them in this outdated education model. What are the consequences that we could be facing?
Well, they're numerous. First of all, let's just look at it from a matter of what we're doing to our children. And what we're really doing is harming them in education to a great deal. That we know that, for example, the mere taking in and regurgitation of information, being lectured to, actually hurts the brain. It's stunting the growth of the brain, and it's sort of, in effect, painful for the brain. So on that level, it's a crisis because we're not only just not doing something positive for students, we're actually hurting them. And that has to be acknowledged and has to get more attention. Second, it's imperative because we are falling behind the rest of the world in terms of how we are developing our children in this regard. Other countries are taking big leaps forward in terms of how they're educating their students to prepare for a world that's constantly in flux, where information is no longer the strongest currency and knowledge is no longer the strongest currency. And we have to be better at that. And there's a crisis in that way. And the third thing is, as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, we had an insurrection at the Capitol. And we see the ramifications and the effects of this kind of education that is built on listening to an authority figure, believing what they tell you, taking in, giving back the right answer. A wrong answer is penalized, and we're not supposed to change our minds. Once we know what the right answer is, we're supposed to keep it, and we're not supposed to question that answer that's given to us by authority. And we can see how people can develop a belief persistence around a false idea, because once it's embraced, once it's given by an authority figure they respect, they take it, they have the right answer, that's what they've been conditioned to do, and they don't question it and think about it. And it's a crisis for those three reasons.
And, of course, the whole idea of critical thinking is to evaluate information objectively, change your mind about something as new information becomes available, rather than holding on to fixed beliefs.
Let me ask you, too. You said that other nations are lapping America in the classrooms that they have. What are they doing right that we're doing wrong? What's an example of one way our educational system could better teach critical thinking skills to kids that we're not currently doing?
Sure, it's a great question. So a lot of countries are moving away from the acquisition of rote knowledge as the primary currency of education. And what they're doing instead is they're moving towards developing skill sets, soft skills, around critical thinking and working groups and collaboration. So they're building classes around problem solving, around innovation, around decision making, and dealing with wicked problems. It's something called problem-based learning. Problem-based learning is learning where we begin by confronting students with a problem and we give them some resources and there's no right answer to that problem. And the students often have a role in determining what the problem is and how to define it, how to quantify it, and so on. And it's what's unfortunate is that in education we have to have a term for something called problem-based learning because life is problem-based learning all the time. The only time that our students are asked to learn like they do when they're in school is when they're in school. Otherwise, we're always learning based on problems that we're confronting. From the time we're very young to the time we die. A problem is how do I get milk when I'm thirsty, or what have you. These are all problems that we're contending with through life, and they get more complex as we get older. You know, early problems are very simple relative to our later problems. But nevertheless, life is all about encountering problems, using the resources around us, and working with people around us to solve them. We just don't do that in school.
Now, you are the co-founder of the Critical Thinking Initiative. You also host podcasts about this. You really are a thought leader in this field. With this new book coming out, have you heard, for example, from educators, teachers, union reps? What's been the response from the educational establishment to your book?
Well, aside from hearing from individual educators, which I've heard from a great number of them, and most of them have been very appreciative of the work because it's expressing a frustration that many of them feel, I haven't heard yet from many organizational leaders, which I hope to do because I would love to be able to start to engage that conversation. But I think it's very hard in academia to promote change. It's a very tight structure. And it's very hard to create change in academia. It's a slow-turning cruise ship. It's certainly not a speedboat.
Change is slow, but in the meantime, you are getting the conversation going. I should say continuing the conversation you've been having for a while. And I would recommend that people pick up this book. It's America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. Stephen J. Perlman, PhD, a pleasure. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Some big news this week. Mayor Lenny Curry and the Jacksonville Transportation Authority have been discussing the possibility of doubling the city's local gas tax with city council members. The proposed increase would help cover a number of transportation projects around town. Reporter David Bauerlein has been covering this story for the Florida Times Union, and he's on the line now with the latest. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning, Ann. Very well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks a lot for being with us this morning. You have been reporting into this story for the last couple of weeks, is my understanding. How did you learn that this project, this proposal was in the works? And tell us a little bit about what it would mean.
So the mayor has talked about it, not in specifics, but a couple of weeks ago, he was talking about some new septic tank funding to complete some projects that were promised actually a few years ago. And he said at that time that he was looking at a much larger package of projects, and the question was how to fund that. And he has been talking with city council members about it. So it's been out there in the public forum. He's been talking to some civic groups. So I should say it's been discussed, not publicly, but it's kind of been moving into that more and more of a decision-making process. So That's how we found about it. It obviously is something that's being discussed and talked about at City Hall. And now it's going to be coming up at some point for an actual vote in the coming months, we would assume, before the summer budget workshops. And basically what it would do is it would take the existing gas tax, which is 6 cents, it would double it for 30 years, so it goes to 12 cents. And it would also take the existing 6 cents that's going to run out and expire in 2036 and add another 10 years to it. So it extends and increases. And that creates a large amount of money that would be coming into the future that can be used for, at this point, they've got $930 million of road projects and transit projects and drainage projects. So it's a very far-reaching type of package. And the other aspect of it is that indirectly, by being able to use this gas tax money for projects that otherwise would be spent, financed with other types of money the city gets, you free up money, and that can then be used for some other long-needed projects, like septic tank phase-outs with extending sewer lines to these neighborhoods that have had septic tanks now for decades.
And implementing this gas tax now, so they would be basically issuing bonds against future revenues. And there's something important about doing this now in terms of the timeliness, the amount of money that people spend on gas currently, and therefore the amount of money that the city could potentially collect. Can you talk a little bit about why that is, why the city is looking at the forecast for the future and thinking about this project now?
Yeah, so the gas tax is one of those taxes that, let's back up. I mean, obviously we have a trend towards greater fuel efficiency, so people can drive the same amount of distance and buy less gas. And then every time you turn around, there's another commercial on TV, it seems, for electric vehicles. So that's a trend, and obviously you're not going to the gas pump at all with that. So there's this thought that as time goes on, the gas tax is going to be limited or constrained by those kind of factors. And there's going to be population growth that'll offset it for a while. But there's probably a period for, say, the next decade where you see some growth in the gas tax. After that, it sort of levels off, and maybe it does not grow it after that, and maybe decline some year after year. So there's a little bit of a window of opportunity to take advantage of the fact that the gas tax is still be projected to grow some over the next decade or so. So that would be one reason to do it now. But and as far as borrowing, some of this would be sort of pay as you go. Some of it would be borrowing by the city. It's a good time to borrow money. I mean, interest rates are low, so there's some advantage to doing that. And then the other decision is, well, is there a benefit to getting some of this done sooner rather than later? Mm-hmm. And that's another part of the decision on why you'd want to borrow money and sort of pump in a large amount of money up front and pay for it over time with the increased revenue you get from the gas tax increase.
There are obviously a lot of infrastructure needs in the city of Jacksonville. And also, I would guess there is some calculation on the part of the mayor about trying to create a little bit of a legacy for his administration. There has been, in the past, needs that have been met, like the Better Jacksonville Plan, which was another big sort of public works project paid for with tax. Is there something about let me ask you, first of all, kind of the mayor's considerations here in terms of what he's trying to create. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about how the city budget is structured in so far as it becomes reliant on these external taxes to pay for basic functions.
Yeah. So the single biggest source of revenue for the city budget is the property tax, which is something that people are reluctant to increase the property tax rates for. It's been the same now for several years. Now, having said that, it's probably on the high end of what it's been over the last couple of decades, for instance. So people don't really like to raise the millage rate, the property tax rate. So you look at other types of revenue sources. And that's where you come into things like the sales tax, the gas tax. Certainly we saw an example of that in November when there was a lot of support within the business community and civic groups when the school board was interested in doing the half-cent sales tax to rebuild and modernize schools. Mm-hmm. And, so the sales tax and the gas tax seem to have more broad buy-in in terms of how to finance these these large-scale projects where you really want to catch up on backlogs and deferred maintenance and just and get a handle on those type of spending issues. It's almost like it's harder to get the millage rate to go through. That's something that affects people differently, and you can argue the gas tax, sales tax, that's paid for as well by people who don't actually live in the county but spend a lot of time here as commuters or visitors.
These sort of funding methods, though, seem to underscore that argument that the city doesn't have the stream of funding that it needs basically to operate, you know, that it doesn't have that rather than doing, you know, maintenance that's been backlogged, that it would be certainly less expensive to stay ahead of it and have a steady funding source that's reliable for future projects, capital improvements, whatever.
Right. I mean, the proof's in the pudding, right? I mean, you know, if you have a backlog, it means there's issues in terms of the having enough funding to be able to cover it. So then you do look at these types of ways to raise money. You know, there was an attempt last summer by some council members to put a property tax rate increase into the budget. It failed, and I would suspect that if that was tried again this summer, it would fail again. So that part of it is not really something that will change, I don't think. So you look at some of these other types of taxes that are have a wider spread of who they affect, and that seems to be where the support is most often going to be found.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual implementation of this. Right now, Duval County charges 6 cents a gallon for its gas tax. It has some flexibility in that, and other counties have implemented more than Duval County has chosen to this point. Can you talk about kind of where they're hoping to take it, how that compares to surrounding counties in the rest of the state?
Sure. So the state legislature and state law limits how high this local tax can go, and it can go as high as 12 cents per gallon. Right now, the city has a 6 cent per gallon gas tax for Duval County. The surrounding counties, Clay is at 12 cents, Nassau is at 12 cents, St. John's is at 6 cents, I believe Baker County is at 7 cents. And when you look across the state, I think it's about 31 counties out of 67 counties have gone up to 12 cents for their gas tax. So, you know, to your previous point, Ann, that shows that maybe Jacksonville's not alone in having a tax a system in place where something like the gas tax is being relied on more and more in order to keep up with these, in often cases, basic transportation needs like resurfacing roads, keeping bridges in good shape, fixing sidewalks, building sidewalks, as well as in the case of this particular proposal, you know, maybe doing some other really big projects like the JTA, Jacksonville Transportation Authority, wanting to do a really big overhaul, refurbishment, extension of the Skyway in downtown Jacksonville. So it does seem to be the case that statewide, the policies of state government have been to create the ability to use these types of gas taxes, sales taxes to supplement funding, and that seems to be where a lot of local governments go when they need money to do this kind of things.
Well, David Bauerline, we really appreciate your reporting. Thanks so much for all the work you do at the Florida Times Union, and thanks a lot for being with us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay.
Congaree & Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpenn.com.
Wingard Marketing and Communications Agency, serving Jacksonville businesses and nonprofits since 2008. Services include branding, media buying, advertising, public relations, and digital marketing. More information can be found at wearewingard.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. A proposed law in Kentucky would make it illegal to insult a police officer. Many say the bill would threaten freedom of speech.
Also, 1 year ago, the NBA canceled all games and suspended the season after a player tested positive for coronavirus. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, John Batiste. He's the music director and bandleader on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and he composed, arranged, and performs the jazz in the animated film Soul. In New York, after George Floyd was killed, he led peaceful protesters in hymns and songs. Now he has a new album called We Are. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The president's promises on immigration are facing an early test. More unaccompanied children are showing up at the southern border. Michael Bennett was part of the so-called Gang of Eight, a bipartisan group of senators who came up with a plan to fix our immigration system. We'll speak to him and look at the challenges that lie ahead. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The Safe Future Foundation is helping hundreds of families by providing food and diaper donations in our area. Melissa recently spoke to Elvina Toby, who's with the foundation, and spoke about their mission. Let's listen.
Hi, Elvina. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me and allowing me to share our foundation and what we provide and do for the community. Thank you.
And you've already had amazing success with the Safe Future Foundation in 2020, giving out food, diapers, helping hundreds of families. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing.
Absolutely. Yes, we've given out food and diapers, sanitary pads to families and particularly mothers in need. Our Safe Future Foundation, it started with hosting our free community baby showers. And we determined after interacting with mothers at our community baby shower that there were more services that was needed for the moms that attended. And so after much planning, we decided to go ahead and launch our diaper bank and food pantry. And so now the same mothers that attended our community baby showers, they actually come and receive diapers and also food and other basic necessities that they struggle with. And due to COVID, COVID really exacerbated those issues and some of the issues that the families were going through. And so the families, the many mothers, they found great relief from coming to our organization, being able to receive those supplies.
Let's talk a little bit more about the diaper need. People underestimate just how great it is. Can you share a little bit about why this is such a critical problem?
Well, it's really tough and challenging, especially with COVID, but 1 in 3 U.S. families struggle with diaper need. And after our community baby shower, we found that it was so many mothers, they never knew what a diaper bank or what diaper need was, you know, what it was exactly until they were able to see our organization provide diapers. And they thought, well, hey, we could really use this. And then we also had other organizations such as Episcopal Children's Services partner with us, and they also shared the huge need that they see their families also struggling with, because they do home visits, and they visit mothers and parents doing their home visits. And so they also shared with us the importance of diapers and other basic necessities that their families needed. So we also partner with Episcopal Children's Services, and so they come to all of our events. And we provide diapers free to the community. And due to COVID, all the families, participants remain in their vehicles, and they come through the vehicle at our distributions, and we give them diapers, food, and other supplies that they may need.
How can people support the Safe Future Foundation? Hopefully, there won't be as much need for it this year, but there's always a need.
Yes, there's always a need. We do, okay, so the second Saturday, that's our staple. We're there every second Saturday at the Duval County Health Department. That address is 515 West 6th Street, Jacksonville, Florida, 32206. And it's also listed on our website at asafefuture.org. They can go under our events and see where we're going to be at, because we're not only at the Duval County Health Department, but we also travel throughout the community and do pop-ups at other areas such as the YMCA, My Angel Kids Pediatrics, to where we go and give out other supplies as well. So if a family is in need, they can come, go on our website and also our social media page and see where we're going to be at. People, they can also support us. We have a diaper drive that we're doing. They can go on yougivegoods.com/safefuturediaperdrive, and also our Walmart registry for good wish list. They can purchase supplies to help us continue giving out diapers and other baby essentials. When they purchase those supplies, it comes directly to our warehouse.
Directly to the warehouse. Thank you so much, Alvina Toby of the Safe Future Foundation. Thanks
for
sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests today and our producer, Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you've got questions or comments about First Coast Connect, please send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Ann Schindler, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, but if you missed anything, you can listen to the replay on wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.